This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, we've had a brilliant week. In fact, every week's a brilliant week, but I've got an incredible story about the guy who probably inspired Sir Human Rowe to catalogue all the hills over 3,000 feet. And I'm looking at Scotland's most unpopular map and trying to find out if it's deserved.
I met a lady entirely by accident who is likely to make a reasonable living out of 10 acres of land.
That's not easy.
No, it's not. A really clever idea. And basically, from planting to harvest will be about 5 months. So it's a clever, clever idea. And I also meet a guy. I'm like, I was so envious of this. What this guy found, I have wanted for years and years. I mean, literally, since I was a teenager, I used to see these things in my local museum. I thought, oh, I'd really like one of those. And this guy found one just lying in the ground.
Wow. So what was it?
I'm not telling you.
Okay.
Wait till later in the podcast. Now, if you live out with Scotland, and if you're listening to this podcast, there's a fair chance you might be out with Scotland, you may or may not have heard of a guy called Jim McCall. Gentleman Jim McCall is the doyen of Scottish gardeners. He's been doing a programme called the Beech Grove Garden for over 40 years now. I've been lucky enough to know and work with Jim for a lot of those years. And for those of a certain vintage, this music will bring back a lot of happy memories.
It was an extraordinary experience because I was working for the College of Agriculture and I had done a piece out at Craibston, and it was a food programme thing because we were doing trials of different crops to suit polytunnels, which had just suddenly become the real business. It was extending the season for market gardeners. So what should they be growing and what were the best combinations? And then the next thing I got was a phone call from Pat Chalmers. He was the boss man in BBC in Aberdeen at the time. Would you fancy getting a wee shot at it? Then, of course, have you ever heard of George Barron? Because we see this as a duo. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I know who he is, but our paths have never crossed. I'm in the commercial side of things at the college and so on, and he's out there at Pitmedden. So in the meantime, I had started to host a gardening programme on the radio. So once they said, we're going to have George Barron, I said, well, we'll get him on the radio programme. And that was the first time we met. He came in as a guest on the programme.
How long did it take before you and George actually clicked? You know, in terms of, because it was like a sort of performance duo.
Yes. You can't manufacture that.
No.
You can't. This is comes up in talk all the time, you know, wherever we are. We talk about that. What about you and George? How did you get on? My explanation is that he came from the northeast of Scotland. I came from the southwest of Scotland. So we had an entirely different background and our experience of horticulture to that point. I was a smart arse that went to college, and he'd learned the hard way. Uh-huh. And the important thing is we never competed. There was never, ever... there was once I said that you should prune your gooseberries in February, because that's how we pruned them in the West. No, that's rubbish, isn't it? It was a panel thing, you see. And the fact of the matter is that we never competed. We came from a different background, but we just loved the job and we got on like a house on fire.
How has the programme changed in 40 years?
It changes regularly. I mean, it evolves, of course. Mm-hmm. But the big change was when we came out here. And we had people say, how big is this garden compared with the other? Well, the other one was obviously just the back garden in town. This here I describe as being about the size of two football pitches. It gives people a sort of idea. So scope. It gave us scope to do all sorts of things. It had been a tree nursery. And some of the trees you can see way up behind us here were a part of the original thing when we came in. But so it was levelled and it was terraced and these walls were put in and stuff. And basically, I mean, the original comment was, how did you get the Beechgrove started and how did you set your standards? We said, well, let's do a semi-detached suburban garden. What can you get in it?
What's the role of a programme like the Beechgrove Garden? What's the purpose of it?
I've always taken the view that we have a number of keen gardeners, some qualified gardeners who know what they're doing, they can understand the weather, etc. And it's to make that a simple wee story for Joe Bloggs, who just likes to keep a nice place. But then you get, as I say, we then move into this whole idea, we're going to be looking at overwintered veggies now. You listen to or watch Mary Berry, you know, and how many different things that she put in her recipes, things that we never had before. I mean, I was born up in a working-class household. I was 24 when I went to England. It was the first time I was served a dish of meat, potatoes and two veg. It was the first time I ever tasted runner beans. And I was 24 years old. Do you know what I mean? So there's been so much more in the interim and in this period of time to engage with the cooking side of things, the flower arranging side of things. Then you've got the communities in bloom and getting people involved.
But just in terms of transmission of ideas, because I would contend that in the past, say 50 years ago, you learned gardening from your father.
Yes.
Oh, your grandfather.
Yes.
You were out there double digging with them. You were unpaid help, essentially. That doesn't tend to happen so much anymore.
No, it doesn't. I mean, people have got different ideas. I mean, but society is changing. In 1961, I moved to Shropshire, to the Education Authority there, and I was an assistant lecturer and so on for City and Guilds and these kind of things. But nearly every school in Shropshire had a garden. And if you like to go further back than that, George Barron, age 11, was told, the Hedy's needing to see you. Went to see the Hedy at the summer holidays, and the Hedy said, there's the key to the garden shed, you're looking after the garden for the summer. That was the school garden, George's time. So I'm talking about 1961. I went to Shropshire, and I had the kind of east side of the county, which is all of Telford and that area nowadays, and nearly every school had a school garden, and some of them were quite large. So we supplied them with information and so on and help, and we did demonstrations and so on. But we also, through the education budgets, we got them a greenhouse, and I introduced the idea of a greenhouse with a partition so that you could heat one little bit. I still do that at home now. I mean, I've got a little bit that's heated, the rest of it's cold. You know, that was way, way back, as I say, in the 60s. So they were learning then, and some of them, I'm quite sure, would keep on doing it. Others would go on and do other things. And the same is happening again now.
When people go out gardening, when they're actively getting their hands in the soil, when they're seeing things grow, how does it benefit them?
Well, I tell you what, it takes their mind off the other things. Suddenly, it's such an easy thing to become absorbed in. Go to a classic story, and I was at the Trellis conference in Perth a couple of months ago. Trellis is helping people with learning difficulties and actually being the overall, we will put you in the right place. And the first presentation was with some warders from Dumfries Prison. Now, last year I went to the day out. The boss man of the prison, he sidled up. He said, this is remarkable, because they were doing a pallet garden or something like that, but there was carpentry, there was wrought iron work, there was artistry, there was everything in it. And when they're doing that, their mind is off the other stuff. It's as simple as that. These guys at Dumfries, they have a terrific setup there. They've got big areas of plot, and they have a cafe. They have a cafe that the public can come into. They supply the stuff, and you know, it's all very, very positive. No, it's not going to work for everybody, but it works for a lot of people. You know, there's some people have no time for it. There are some people that wander around here and they'll not see half the stuff. All they see is, oh, that's a lovely blue flower, or that's a yellow thing. So you can get it at any level you like. You can take it at any level you like, and it's aye there.
Gentleman Jim McCall there. Facing retirement after, 41 years. This will be his 41st series that he's kicked off.
Yeah, that music is the first series 78, I think it was. Very distinctive.
Oh, we've been at it a long time.
When it burst onto the Scottish airwaves. So, as you heard there, Jim's not just a great gardener in Scotland, he's a great storyteller.
Yeah.
And I've been in his company quite a few times, and it's just, it's like sitting down with your grandfather telling stories. It's fantastic.
Anyway, you may have heard our journey last week along the River Ithen. Now, as ever, we end up with too much material and too little time. The village of Methlick sits on the River Ithen, and you went to visit a location just outside it.
Yeah, I kind of sort of went off the river a wee bit and came upon this.
Ian, introduce yourself and tell me the name of the farm.
My name's Ian Gordon. I've run this farm here at Castlehill Farm in Methlick for about 10 years or so.
So how big is it?
We've got 75 acres here, and a couple of miles over the road we've got another farm with 66 acres.
Now, by northeast standards, that's not massive.
No, it's still quite small, but we're more of a selective breeding rather than your average Aberdeenshire farm.
Now, the more discerning listener will quickly identify that it's not sheep here, it's not cows, it's goats, a lot of goats.
Yeah, we are breeding pedigree and commercial boer goat.
How did you come to be here? Because, you know, we weren't a farmer originally.
We initially wanted to move out to the countryside to have a family. And we saw a house up for sale with a couple of sheds and a little bit of land.
Well, you thought you'd go and live the dream.
So we thought we'd go and live the dream, aye.
So yeah. What were you doing before?
I'm a qualified engineer, electrician, did offshore work.
That's a big leap.
It sure is. Lifestyle change. But when you want to raise a family out in the countryside, you kind of need to make a move.
It's all very well to make the move and have the dream, but what was the reality like?
The reality like was quite hard work. The dream wasn't quite there for a start.
You've got your land. How did you decide you were going to make a living to start with?
We looked at the land, what we thought we'd do since we had grass, some crops. We thought we'd do a little bit of maintenance of the ground, put some fencing in. So as time went on, we got some livestock. We'd be able to contain our animals.
Just sheep or cattle?
We had sheep initially, and then we got built the gully with cattle. And then as time moved on, my partner Maxine, she really fancied a couple of goats. So we went and got a 9-10 goats, and it's escalated from there.
Why goats?
Quite an inquisitive animal, allegedly a superfood, and a nice animal to work with.
Now, it's all very well having a handful of goats. How many have you got now?
We're sitting about 160 at the moment. And we're kind of, wait to start, we've actually started kidding. And we're at this section, we've got about 80 does at this, when I wait to start kidding, yeah.
You're going to have to explain the terminology here. Kids, I understand. What's the doe?
The doe is a female goat.
I thought that was a nanny.
No, the boer goats, it's the doe, and we've got bucks. And the bucks are lads.
So the billy goats and the nanny goats is nonsense?
In the dairy industry, yeah. But not in the boer goat side of things now.
So what are you growing them for? Is it milk? Is it meat?
We initially started off just commercial, and it was just mainly for meat. But now we've kind of changed. We're farming a little bit and taking in better stock, and we're now selling pedigree. And we're selling traditional and full red pedigree stock also.
So you're supplying other farmers now?
Yes, we're supplying other farmers, and we're supplying other people for fattening stock.
So how easy is it to get the ones you want? Because I know nothing about goats, but these look magnificent. They're biggish and they're shiny and they look really alert.
With us being high health, the issue being is there's only a select amount of breeders who are actually high health that we can get stock from. So the only way, possibly the way we can kind of go forward is artificial insemination and embryos as well. Yeah.
So where are these guys from?
At least 50% of these are homegrown, but what we've had to do is this last breeding season we took an Australian semen and inseminated a few of our girls.
Well, why Australian?
They imported from South Africa to Australia, and we can manage to import from Australia to the UK.
So are South African ones better than UK ones?
Well, the South African ones, initially that's where they came from, so that's where the animal thrives, just fantastic. And then they imported them over to Australia, and Australia's doing quite well with it.
This is probably a question I should ask right at the start. What is a goat?
It's a rumen, similar to a cow. It has a couple of stomachs. It goes in, a bit of fermentation, and moves on to the next one.
Because they've got a reputation for being able to eat anything. I presume that's nonsense if you're doing it commercially.
And that is nonsense. Very selective eating. The better the quality of the feed, the better you're going to get out of the animal. And the animal needs a proper vitamin and mineral.
You mentioned the does and the kids. Can we have a wee look?
Of course we can. Let's go and have a look. Yeah, no worries.
So the inside or the outside?
We have two groups. We've got one down here in the left-hand shed here. We've got a few kids here. We've got a few sets of triplets and a few sets of twins so far. Early days yet.
That's pretty good, though.
Yeah, it's a good start. We're doing there. We're getting nice and slow, kind of steady.
So we're going into a darkened shed. Certainly, if you've been in a lambing shed, you get that lovely kind of half light.
We've got half a dozen pens made up. So we've got two bays here, cleaned out, new bedding down.
Lovely deep bed of straw.
Yeah.
And there's your... Oh, goodness me. These are super cute. Are you past that stage? I mean, yeah, this is the puppy of the agricultural world. They're gorgeous.
It is, I've got to say, you know, especially when you're born naturally and you look at them and you can see the animal with the stance, and you're striving every year to produce better and better stock. So when you see them coming out, within 10, 15 minutes, they're on their feet, milking on their mum, you know you've got a lovely, strong animal.
It's a lovely, milky white, and then they've got this really distinctive browns, wrong the word, tan head with the big, long, floppy ears. It's almost like a Labrador. Gorgeous.
Very much feel like a Labrador. A lot of people come to the farm and say they're a little bit like a spaniel as well with the great long ears. A lovely, soft animal, you know. The temperament of these animals are excellent. I've got to say, a very good animal to work with.
So do you suffer from the fact people like me come and say, can I take one of them now?
Ever so. It does happen quite a lot. A lot of people come to the farm and say, oh, can I buy a goat and have it at home? But we tend to say to people, you're better off maybe two or more. Very hospitable and very sociable animals, and they tend to like company. So yeah, a lovely animal.
Looking back in it over the years, was that a good move?
I would say so.
You've got your children here.
I would say it's a good move. The view's beautiful. The lifestyle's beautiful. My children go to a lovely country school. And the animals, we just seem to every year get better and better.
So do you get bigger after this, or have you reached the ideal state?
This next year, we're kind of just diversifying a little bit with the goats. This next breeding season, 19 into 20, we're taking in some more genetics. So we're kind of looking to change things a little bit better, and then just improvements as we do year on year. But no, I think we're in here for the long haul with these goats. Yeah.
So how many of those ended up in the back of your car?
Well, I had four in the back of the car till Ian got a hold of me.
Two in the passenger seat.
He was obviously very experienced.
Put them back.
But Laura Cuttle was with me, one of our production team, and she was desperate for one as well. If you imagine puppies meeting bunny rabbits with big long ears, just gorgeous. Because I've never even been a big fan of goats, big ugly, hairy, smelly things.
Uh-huh.
These are beautiful.
Doe, a goat, a female goat. It just doesn't scan, does it?
Boar. A lot of dose to go.
Something along those lines. I was out the other day on my bike. I haven't been out on the bike for ages. I needed to go and drop something off, so I stuck the bike in the back of the vehicle. Had to cycle back 7 or 8 miles, and I thought I was going great guns. I thought, I'm fitter than I thought. This is fantastic. I'm fairly whizzing along the road here, little realising there was probably like a sort of 30-mile-an-hour tailwind. So as soon as I turned the corner, I went, ah.
So you got off and walked after.
Yeah, got off and lay down the verge and cried. But got to the top of the hill, and there was a heap of cars parked in a field where there shouldn't have been heaps of cars parked. And I thought, what's going on there?
Oh, what's going to ask?
Well, that's exactly what happened. Somebody came out of the car, happened to recognise them, said, what's going on? And I thought, I'll go and get my recording equipment. And this was the result.
My name is Jenny File, and I set up Udney Pumpkins 3 years ago. So we have a pumpkin patch once a year in the run-up to Halloween. But in April, we also do pumpkin planting sessions so that children can come and actually plant their own pumpkins. They take one pumpkin to grow at home, and then they leave one pumpkin here at Udney Pumpkins, and I try and grow it for them into a nice big pumpkin in time for Halloween.
How successful is this across these years? Because as I understand it, a bit like Topsy, it's growed and growed.
Yeah, well, it has. It's been amazing, actually. I've been overwhelmed by how popular it's become. Seems that I think the parents really enjoy seeing their children outside getting muddy, getting their hands dirty, and learning about how things grow and where food comes from.
How many pumpkins did you plant in year one, and how many are you planting this year?
Well, in year one, I did actually plant 1,000 pumpkins, but only about 200 of them grew.
Okay.
Last year, I was much more successful, and I ended up having about 1,000 pumpkins in the field. This year, I'm planning to plant 4,000 pumpkins. I'm not quite sure how I'll manage, but that's the plan. So I've actually built a much bigger polytunnel to start them all off in. and we'll just take it from there and see how we get on.
These planting sessions, how do you organise something? Is it ticketed? I mean, is it within a sort of certain time window?
Yes, so everybody at the planting sessions has booked an hour's session. So they come along at a certain time, and in that hour they get a chance to plant their pumpkin and learn a bit about how they grow. And then they also get a chance to visit our animals, because we've got some quite tame sheep, some turkeys and some chickens that they can feed, and they also get to hold a baby chick or a baby duckling.
Okay.
So that's their hour, and they get to run around and play on the hay bales.
My name's Kelly Abel. We live in the local town in Brewery. I'm here with my two daughters, aged 6 and 4, to plant some pumpkins.
And get muddy.
Get very muddy and hopefully see some animals as well.
Have you done this before?
We have. We came in autumn last year and picked some pumpkins and saw the animals, and we just had the most brilliant afternoon. And so when we saw that you could come and actually plant your own pumpkin in the spring, we booked up and we've come along. We've been following the progress of the farm. We follow it on Facebook, so you see when the lambs are born and you see when the pumpkins are growing. So it's not just a kind of, you come twice a year, you actually see the progress on Facebook throughout the year. So it's brilliant. We love it.
At the moment, they've just finished planting their pumpkins in their pots. They've got one colourful pot which they take home with them to grow at home.
Yeah.
And then they've got one pot that stays here, and that's the one I grow on for them. And now they're labelling their pumpkins. So they've planted them, and now they're writing their names on their labels and colouring them in and making them look pretty before they take them home.
Kids are notoriously rubbish at patience. And I mean, this is a lark that's going to run across 5 months.
Yes, they're going to have to wait and see what happens. But the good thing is that even in a few days, they might see something come out of the soil when they take their pumpkins home. It might just be weeds. Mm-hmm. But in about a week, they'll hopefully see the pumpkin itself begin to grow. And then they just love it. I've had messages from parents saying that the children are obsessed with their pumpkins. They're watching them every day. They're seeing how they change and how they grow. And it's lovely. So I think it really captures their imagination.
What did you do before this, before you were a pumpkin queen?
Well, I used to be a journalist, actually.
You seem like such a nice person, too.
Yeah, I know. Maybe that's why I'm not a journalist anymore. No, I was on The Scotsman. I used to be the environment correspondent at The Scotsman. So I've always been really interested in environmental things. When I had young children, I left The Scotsman and we moved up to Aberdeenshire. I used to live in Edinburgh. I actually used to live in a two-bedroom flat in the middle of Edinburgh, and we had a total change of lifestyle, and now we live in a 10-acre small holding in Aberdeenshire, and I just love it. It's just really good fun. There's no rush if anyone is still colouring in their labels.
Lily,
take your time.
Lily, don't touch it.
I think you've all done a beautiful job, but the next thing we're going to do is we're going to go and see some baby chicks and some baby ducklings.
Lily, do you want to go and see the ducks?
And you will get a chance to touch them. Okay.
Do you want to touch the little duckies?
Now, it's a very cold, windy day outside today, and I can only take half of you at once, okay? So the other half, you can either go exploring and see the animals again, or you can wait in the warm polytunnel. It's up to you. Okay. Now they're just over here in the barn. Okay. Right. Now, boys and girls, these chicks and ducklings are very, very young, and they're very, very small. So we're going to have to be a little bit quiet, but most importantly, you're going to have to be really gentle. Is everyone good at being gentle?
I yeah.
bet you all are, aren't you? Right, let's go and find them, shall we? Right, so we've got lots of chicks in there, and then we've actually also got 3 ducklings. Can anyone spot the ducklings? Yeah. What's the difference between the duckling and the chick, do you think? How can you spot the ducklings?
Because they're bigger.
Bigger, yeah, one of them is really big.
And one beak.
And it's got a round beak, hasn't it? Mm. Well done. The chicks have got little spiky beaks. And the ducks have got much rounder ones. Now we've got a really big duckling there. He's about 2.5 weeks old. And then can you see that little yellow duckling there? Mm. That one's only 4 days old, so that one's really young.
See the looks of concentration in these kids' faces. Absolutely mesmerised by these critters.
Would anybody like to try holding or touching one of them? Yeah?
Hold them.
Brilliant. Okay. So here's our little duckling. That one's just a bit, very little baby, just 4 days old. Can you put one hand out flat for me? Have you done this before?
Yeah.
You know what you're doing. So just keep its wings nice and snug and it will wriggle. Oh, you're good at that. Well done.
That's great.
Wondering where its pals have gone.
Look, it's where to be. See? Quite different from our chicks.
Yeah, you're quite loud, aren't you?
Yeah.
You've
got something. Where have my friends gone?
You've got a lot to say for yourself, haven't you?
When I grow up, I'd like to be a farmer working on this farm.
Are you going to come and help me? Because I've got 4,000 pumpkins to plant. I could do with a hand.
Yes.
Oh, brilliant. Excellent. Good stuff.
Queen of the Pumpkins, Jenny Fyle there, and here's a large crop of pumpkins ready in time for Halloween.
You've got a field about the same size, haven't you?
Yeah, I was lost in admiration. She set it up really well, and the thing is, she's good. She's good with the kids. The kids were obviously thoroughly enjoying themselves. They were getting mucky. They were planting up the pumpkin seeds. They were, you know, playing with the chicks and things, and the lambs outside. It's clever. It makes a connection between people who wouldn't normally be anywhere near a farm and what's actually going on in
you
the country.
You can do it with sunflowers.
Yeah. Yeah,
possible. Plant them, collect them, and you could do sunflowers and horses.
No, I suspect the horses would eat the sunflowers. It would be catastrophic, frankly. Now, the name is Sir Hugh Munro, synonymous with peaks over 3,000 feet. Now, as we had a few weeks ago, on the 100th anniversary of his death, Munro's list of peaks may well have been inspired by somebody completely different. Surprisingly, I hadn't heard of it at all.
And you should have, because you're into this subject. He's called Professor Matthew Heddle from Orkney, and he listed some of the Munros many years before. Well, almost all the Munros. Here's a wee reminder of how Munro and Heddle became aware of each other.
They met by chance in 1883 on a mail coach travelling from Kinussi to Fort William. Heddle was on it because he'd been invited to participate in the opening ceremony of the Ben Nevis Observatory. They talked on the coach for something like 2 hours, and thereafter, Munro, who was only 27 at the time, Heddle was 55, immediately acquired a huge admiration for Heddle and had a huge regard for him.
Did he nick his idea?
The Scottish Mountaineering Club was established in 1889, and it had already asked Munro to do the research and create the list. But with him knowing Heddle, there's no doubt at all that he knew of Heddle's considerable achievements.
So did Munro have access to Heddle's work?
He did, because Heddle provided Munro with about 15 aneroid measurements of mountains that he had climbed that the Ordnance Survey hadn't climbed. And he used these, and indeed measurements by other climbers, in the tables. But I think it's very likely that Heddle would have given Munro his own list of 409 to help him on his way.
Very generous of him.
Well, Heddle was above all a scientist who believed in truth and information. He was a teacher and he shared information very freely.
That was Hamish Johnson, the great-great-grandson of Matthew Heddle. I must admit, I hadn't heard of him either.
No.
To our eternal shame. Heddle's collection of minerals and rocks is one of the most important in the world, and it's housed in the store for the National Museum of Scotland. Like most museums, the stuff they haven't got on show goes in a big store. And it is, because you're really into your rocks.
I know. And I didn't get to go. I mean, this is as bad for me as you getting to go in the footplate of the Flying Scotsman.
Yeah.
And me not.
Well, you got to go in a biplane.
Well, anyway, that's true, but you know. Then again, you know,
this is
nice things happen to nice people normally, but not in this case.
And then you wonder why nobody gives you any sympathy for your job. Anyway, the collection resides in the store in Leith. Here's more from Hamish Johnson and Peter Davidson, who's in charge.
We're in the geological store in our collection centre down at Granton, and the entire collection of Heddle and many others are stored here for safekeeping.
I didn't even know this existed. I thought we were going to the National Museum. I turned up at Chambers Street and said, no, you're going down to Leith. And it's like a futuristic, I don't know, it's just shelf after shelf after shelf of rocks and minerals of every kind.
We're just one of the, I guess, smaller areas. If you go to Across the road, you've got the archaeological finds, so all the archaeological material. Above us, we have other sections of the natural history collections, like insects and birds. But the minerals and rocks are all stored in this single room now, whereas before they were in separate stores.
We are here to talk about Heddle. We chatted earlier on about his love of the mountains, but he was really important to the amount of minerals that were collected in Scotland. How many did he collect?
Well, his collection that was acquired by the museum in 1895 was around 7,000 minerals. Of these, a significant number were discovered personally by Heddle himself. And to do this, he covered the entire countryside of Scotland, all the islands, all the mountains, all the glens, checking on all the previously recorded localities of minerals, and then, of course, going to all the areas that hadn't been explored by other people.
And he produced these incredible maps. You've got the geological map of Sutherland. I mean, talk me through that, because the different colours are different rocks.
That's it? Right. I mean, it's now a generally accepted standard practice to colour geological maps with different colours to signify different rock types. And now we use a standard system of coloration as well, so that geologists, no matter where they are, would recognise, without even referring to the legend, what colour referred to what rock. But Heddle actually created his own, in a sense, his own colour scheme, which is the non-standard one, which we see. But nevertheless, as long as you've got the legend at the side that tells you the rocks it refers to, you can essentially use any colour you want.
And he pulled all the data together.
He did, yes. He compiled and wrote the famous Mineralogy of Scotland, which is his main work. And the strength of the book is that he tied in the data on the mineral, the individual minerals, with location information, locality information, which for anybody who wants to collect Scottish minerals is absolutely invaluable.
I mean, you've got two well-used volumes there.
Yes.
Are they any good?
Oh, they are amazingly good. And they're well constructed as well. So they're easy to use. They have a very simple scheme where you go from the index to the mineral sample. And they don't require that much technical knowledge as well. So they can be used by academics who want to look at the mineralogy of Scotland in a much more fine detail. But they can be used by anybody who wants to collect Scottish minerals, because the data is at many levels.
But would you still use it today?
I do still use it today. I use it every week when I'm doing my research. So it's a book that I have beside my desk all the time.
Is there any evidence of how he actually got to places? Did he keep records of that?
Well, he would have recorded in the maps the actual routes that he took, and these can be followed when you look at the map. They're marked quite distinctively in red.
So is this a map here, is it?
This is a map here of Sutherland.
Oh, let's open up and have a wee look. It's just a tiny little book.
It is a tiny little book, but it folds out quite well.
Delicately, because it's a very old volume.
I mean, it's a standard published work by a famous Edinburgh firm, on which he has then annotated his routes, and they follow the routes in these red, very nicely drawn lines, marking out exactly where he went.
And he was going up some serious mountains.
It was, yes. I mean, when you think of the time, the road system in Scotland, even though it was better than it was still kind of basic. So getting around would have been difficult and would require him to, literally, physically.
He looks like really fit, though. I mean, look, we've got one of the examples of rock here. Yeah. Presumably that's a cut one.
That was part of a much larger boulder that he found, which he then broke up into manageable sized chunks. But some of the specimens he brought back were actually much larger, and he would carry them from the top of the mountain, I guess, right down to wherever he was staying in lodgings or to wherever his transport was based.
So did he carry a sledgehammer or did he have a stick of dynamite?
He was famous for carrying a very large sledgehammer that weighed 22 pounds, and there's pictures of him with this hammer as well. So, even today, I would never carry a hammer that size.
How important was he? Put him in some kind of context. How important is he?
In Scottish mineralogy terms, there probably isn't that many other people who could surpass him. He was the first to really set out a mineralogy of Scotland that was as well documented, well tabulated, and as well set out as his Mineralogy of Scotland book was. I mean, there were others before who had written about mineralogy in Scotland, but certainly he was one of the first to bring it all together in a kind of very manageable two volumes, in fact, with detailed drawings and locality information. And it was a real boon to anybody who was interested in Scottish minerals.
Hamish, when we talked about his contribution to enabling Munro to publish his book of hills and mountains over 3,000 feet, I made the point that nobody's ever heard of him. But it must be slightly reassuring to hear how important he is today in terms of mineralogy.
Well, absolutely. As his great-great-grandson, I'm immensely proud of him. And I'm also proud that, having discovered that nobody had written about his life, that I was able to do the research and produce a biography. And it tells all sorts of amazing stories, not just about him, but also about his father and his family and his exploits in the gold fields of South Africa and countless other anecdotes.
Amos Johnson, the great-great-grandson of Matthew Heddle and Peter Davidson, curator of mineralogy at the Scottish Museum. There must be a reason for me to go back there and do something else.
You know, the stuff with Heddle was fascinating, but it was a, you know, 10,000, or I can't remember what the actual figure was. That was a tiny percentage of the rocks. If you imagine, it's two stories high, and this huge long building, millions of rocks of all kinds. Each one with different names as well. That must be a challenge.
But a 22-pound sledgehammer humping it up and down hills.
He must have been incredible, because he was going up mountains of 3,000 feet.
Yeah.
And not just doing one, it would be two or three.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the rocks as well.
And hauling them back down
Hauling them back down again. And, you know, some of them he couldn't smash up. I mean, you wouldn't want to arm wrestle with him.
Wouldn't have thought so. Who was Arkwright?
It's something to do with a mill.
Was it? Very good, very good. Richard Arkwright, English cotton baron, pioneer of the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s. No, obviously, that was down south, but there is actually an Arkwright connection right here in Scotland, a place where Arkwright had direct involvement. It's called Stanley Mills. It's a place I'd never actually been before, and Ailie Sinclair showed me around.
Mill was built here at Stanley, although it wasn't called that then because the village was only created for the mill itself, but it was built here because of the River Tay. It's the fastest flowing river in the whole of Britain, and it's that power from the Tay which is coming into the mill and making all the machinery work, and they're using those water wheels to power that machinery using various systems of shafts and mechanisms as well.
To say that the mill is built on a bend in the river is to indulge in mild understatement. It's a hair, I mean, literally, it doubles back on itself. You've got a huge amount of water here. And even allowing for that, they drilled holes through the hill to access more water.
Absolutely. It was actually in 1729 they did the first tunnel here at Stanley because there was a corn mill here at that point. And it's that idea that was already here that allowed the Duke of Athol to come along and think, aha, this would be a perfect point to put a cotton mill. The oldest building on site is on the right-hand side. It's our Bell Mill. It's a brick building, and it is from the early days of the Industrial Revolution. It was actually designed by Richard Arkwright, and is the best surviving example of one of his buildings anywhere, as well as that probably one of the earliest examples you'll find anywhere of a cotton mill.
It's actually extremely imposing. The building on the right-hand side is red brick. There's a sort of almost a purpley sandstone ahead. That sits over two arches. There's lades underneath. It's a rabbit warren. It's a bit like standing next to Venice.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here because what happens is over time at the mill, they add buildings.
Uh-huh.
So we've got the mid-mill beside the Bell Mills from about 1824, roughly. And underneath the mid-mill, as you will see, we've got the arches you describe are the wheel pits. So these are later wheel pits. The earliest were actually inside the Bell Mill. You can see evidence of that inside the building.
If you go somewhere like New Lanark, it has the same feel to it. It's very orderly, it's very neat, it's very tidy. It's obviously a planned environment. The lives of the people that worked there kind of followed the same pattern. Was it the same here?
Absolutely. It was a very regimented life. The people coming here to work at the mill initially were coming here from the lands of the Duke of Athol. It was during the Highland Clearances when they're removing people from the land to allow sheep to come because it was more profitable for sheep. So they're coming here and they may be speaking Gaelic, not much English, so it'd be quite an alien landscape for them. They're used to working outside all day and suddenly they're inside and they've got very boring, monotonous jobs and having to do the same thing day in, day out. We know from the Factory Commission report of 1833 that when they came here at Stanley and interviewed people, they were working from about 5:30 in the morning until about 7 o'clock at night.
they only have about two breaks in the day. So they have a 45-minute break at 9 o'clock for your breakfast and at 2 o'clock, 45 minutes for your lunch. Most of the workforce is women and children because they're much cheaper to employ, and the children can do jobs that adults can't, such as going underneath the machinery and fixing the threads as well. It's also a very noisy job, a lot of the machinery. It's very difficult to hear each other. They even create their own sign language so they can communicate with each other over the noise and machinery. It also helps. You can have a little chat with your friend when the foreman's coming to say, watch out, he's coming to coming here as well. It's also very hot in here. They've got to keep the mill at very constant temperature to allow the cotton to be processed. So it's about 20-odd degrees in here in the mill. It's also very dusty. Cotton creates a lot of dust. It's coming here in its raw form, full of bits of husk and other bits of grit and grime. And it's all going into the air and the atmosphere. And of course, that's going into people's lungs as well.
I did a bit of research on this. And, you know, this mill, as big and impressive as it was, thrived, closed, thrived, closed, thrived, closed. I mean, it's, I mean, you could almost chart it on a graph. And initially, they would have used the water literally to mechanically drive. The wheel would have gone round. There was a gearing system that drove the machines. Latterly, they used the water to produce electricity.
Yes, they did. In the 1920s, they built a turbine here at Stanley to allow them to harness that power and for operating the machinery.
And when did this place actually close for the last time?
The mill closed its doors in 1989. In the 1970s, there had been a company buyout, and they actually moved to making acrylics, which is a man-made fibre for things like socks. But over time, they can't really keep up with the change of pace that's going on in the world at this time, and eventually it can no longer afford to keep its doors open. So it closes in 1989.
What is this?
I've brought you in to the room where the tar pits are. So in the late 19th century, we have a gentleman taking over control of the mill. He buys the mill in 1880. He's called Frank Stuart Sandeman. And one of his inventions is cotton belting. Now, this belting had to get dipped in the tar so it could actually be used properly, because it's going around the world to be used in machinery. It's powering those machinery for the shafts and things like that. And it still very much smells like a room that could almost be in use today, and you can actually see all the tar still there as well.
And is this an example of the belting here? This is almost like sort of, oh, blimey, that stuff's thick.
Yes, that is an example of it right there.
So basically you would have stapled this together as a drive belt. You could attach this to a steam engine, a tractor, just about anything.
Absolutely. It could be used in any kind of machinery to power it and to help power it as well. Mm. And they'd have to go and clean this out every so often. So men had to get right in there in the tar and empty it all out as well. Very dirty, smelly job.
Yeah.
We're really close to the river here, and that's one of the reasons at times the mill would have to stop production, particularly in the early days, because as soon as the river floods, it will start to flood the mill, flooding the wheel pits and the water wheels. And once you get too much water at a water wheel, that's when it stops working.
Okay.
That's why eventually they'll move on to turbines, which no matter what happens with the water conditions in the river, it could still keep going.
Okay. What always fascinates me about these old buildings, you get it in a lot of previously industrial sites, these big bolts holding the walls together. And it's because the machinery was so heavy and it vibrated. If you didn't do that, the place would literally be shaken to pieces.
The machinery here would be definitely vibrating. And outside in the main wheel pits, you can see examples of that, because you'll see there's grooves in the side of the walls there, and that's where that vibration, when the wheels become a bit unbalanced, has caused issues. And they actually had to move from masonry to adding timber there, which has since rotted away, because the timber absorbed that vibration a lot better than the masonry, whereas the masonry was just breaking.
There's a sign here that says, important looms must be rendered safe against accidental setting on by the use of the isolation switch or lock and catch before any repair or adjustment is attempted.
Yes, yes, brought in health and safety eventually, but it's actually even in the 1970s, we've got pictures downstairs of people covered in the dust and things. It's still not what you expect today.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot in here. We've even got also around the site a lot of graffiti. Some of it from when the mill was closed for a few years, mm-hmm. nobody looking after it until we took over in the mid-1990s, but some of it's clearly original. From the mill was used, and there's some a nice drawing on the windows here. Nice drawing of a lady.
Oh, right.
Yes. And sometimes little stories about who the people are as well, and there's some German on one of the walls and things like that.
So German?
Even some German here, yes. We had a lot of Italian people and German people here coming after the war as well, because we needed that workforce.
Yeah.
So they were coming here, and they were staying in like the Tayside Hotel. That became the kind of youth hostel for them to stay in, and then coming down here to work at the mill.
Ailey Sinclair at Stanley Mills there.
You know, we've been doing this job for a long time, and you keep on thinking you must have done it all, and every week there's another seven or eight stories that you didn't even know about. It's fascinating.
Well, what I like about that place is it's huge. They've still got a lot of the industrial archaeology associated with it, but a good two-thirds of it, I would say, is actually residential. People live there. Nice place to live, too, just in that bend of the river.
Yeah, a lot of these old buildings are fantastic places to live.
Anyway, you're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. Last year, the Ordnance Survey published a list of their least used explorer maps. Incredibly, the first two on the list are actually in Scotland.
It begs the question, why would you want to do that? Or is it to encourage, publish the least popular maps?
I don't know. Why would you... Tell you what, we're stuck for something to do on a Wednesday afternoon. Let's produce a list of the least used explorer maps.
I've got a slight theory that it could be, if you want to be alone, then that's the map for you.
Oh, that's quite clever.
Anyway, we're getting complicated. Anyway, the first one, the second most popular, is Northern my neck of the woods between Fraserburgh and Peterhead. Last week, though, I was in the far north of Scotland, part of the country, holding the title of the official most unpopular map of Great Britain. Ash Smith lives in the area.
I've got an OS Explorer for Glencastley and Glen Oichel, 440.
And this is the most unpopular map in Britain?
Apparently so.
Did that come as a shock?
In a way, yes, and in a way, no. Yes, because we don't see that many people here, and then a real surprise from the point of view that it's so beautiful, you'd think more people would come and see it.
Is it because of the geography? If you turn it over and you can actually see where the map is, it's bang in the north. It's kind of real dead centre.
Yes, it is. And you've also got Glencastley, and that's a no-through road, so, you know, you wouldn't go on from somewhere else to that. And I think a lot of people buy the maps that take you around the NC500, and so not so many people come into the interior.
Are they missing a gem?
Oh, certainly. In fact, what we're seeing is that people coming back a second year because they've loved the NC500 so much, and then they're coming off and they're starting to explore inside.
See, I thought I'd been everywhere, and I haven't. I've never been up this glen, and it's a mistake on my part.
Yeah, it is. It's lovely. It's got everything. You know, it's got woodland at the beginning, and then it opens out into the glen. It's got just a wealth of wildlife. You see red squirrels at the beginning, red deer, osprey.
And we nail us in the head. We saw two osprey as we were coming up the glen.
Just at the beginning, at the very beginning, yeah. And one had a fish in its talons as well, didn't it?
And a lizard. You just come off the main track, and right in front of us is a lizard.
Yeah, it was a good spot. You spotted that. Well done. And it didn't have a tail either. I'm not sure, but I think they can lose their tail.
Yeah, they can.
Attacked.
If something attacks them, they shed the tail. And the tail still wriggles.
Yeah.
And they stand stock still, and the tail wriggles, and the poor old tail gets it.
But he looked lovely just sunning himself on this lovely spring day.
But there is a reason for coming up here, because we're looking down the glen. It is beautiful. It's a gorgeous sunny day. You're going to show me something that's making this place a real must-see destination.
Well, the waterfalls, the Castley waterfalls are just beautiful. Come and have a look.
This is another one I've never heard of. It's not terribly well-known.
Well, I think probably more well-known is the Falls of Shin, where people go to watch the salmon go over. And I think a lot of people that are visiting the area will go there and then feel as though they've done a waterfall and move on to the next destination and not come and see the Castley Falls, which is so lovely.
Well, let's stop for a second. I can just hear it a wee bit through the trees, and we're only about 20 feet from it.
And it's low water as well, so it's not roaring over today.
Right, so about 10 feet away from it now. Yeah, beginning to get there. And I'm not going to look at it yet, because I'm getting quite excited about this. We're 5 feet away. And then you come to the edge.
Careful.
Wow. That's beautiful, isn't it?
It is lovely, isn't it?
It's about 40 feet across, and there's a rise of about 30 feet, and the water splits into two, and it's just a boiling, seething cauldron at the bottom.
It's sort of framed by the pine trees behind as well. And when the salmon go over, they go over in the right-hand falls, the wider falls. But it goes on. There are falls all the way down.
That must be a really impressive sight when the salmon are going up.
It's wonderful. If you bring guests up or friends up to see, they can't help but go, whoa, when the salmon go over the top.
See, why would you not want to see that?
I think if you love nature, you have to watch salmon going over the falls. The amount of effort that they put into it is just incredible.
Would you like to see more people here? Is there the capacity? Because it's an oft-voiced complaint for the North Coast 500 that it was a really good idea, but it's been a victim of its own popularity.
I think we would like to see some more visitors, but I think we can grow organically. And we've started a little tourism group in the area called the Heart of Sutherland Tourism. And we've sort of all joined together to try and promote our area. We've got fantastic restaurants, lovely bed and breakfast and incredible scenery.
But is that message getting out there?
Slowly. I mean, certainly we're seeing a gradual increase year on year.
Are you getting a spin-off from the North Coast 500 or people just queek round and miss you out?
I think it comes in its second year. So, you know, people do the NC 500 and they love it, and then they come back. And when they come back, then they start to come off and explore the interior.
So would you like to see OS 440 the most popular map in Britain, or just a little bit more popular?
Just a tiny bit more popular. Definitely not the most popular, because that's what's magical about it. And we do want to share it with other people, but not in a way that brings so many people here that it's not as lovely.
Ash Smith from the Heart of Sutherland Tourism at Castley Falls in Sutherland.
Yeah, so if you're touring Scotland, only two of you are allowed to go. It's almost...
Otherwise we'll get the blame.
Should have tickets.
Aye. Ticketed access. The day it'll happen one of these fine days.
It's going to happen to Sky and it's going to happen to the North Coast 500 because it is really, really popular.
Very.
I was thinking about this... Basically, if you're listening to other parts of the world, because of films that were made on Sky, because of the route, the North Coast 500, it's become incredibly popular, and it's made life difficult in places like Sky. And Edinburgh is chock-a-block. Yeah. I was thinking, it should be like the Galapagos. Uh-huh. They have a limit on the number of people, and once you reach that limit, it's closed. You need a visa to get in.
Does it not become a bit exclusive, then?
Well, because
elitist.
The price goes up, and it's only the rich that can afford to go. But it's a difficult problem, but... More on that in another programme. But if you've got thoughts on it, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. It's a nice problem to have. How do we solve it?
When I was a teenager, I lived in a place called Inverurie in Aberdeenshire, and it had a very good public library, which was run by a guy called Ossie Prosser back then. Now, sadly, no longer with us.
They used to build steam trains there when you were a boy.
They did. Well, they didn't build them, they repaired them. That kind of thing. But and it wasn't just steam trains, it was diesel trains too. But the steam trains, you know, that was regarded as being elite. You know, the diesel was regarded as being a bit dirty. But anyway, Ossie Prosser, library. He had a collection of stuff, you know, upstairs in a cupboard. And one of the things he had was about five or six of these items that we're just going to talk about. And I must confess, I looked at these things. Nobody knows what they're for. Absolutely fascinating. Up to 4,000 years old, and I really... really, really wanted one of these things. So I was down in Perth Museum recently talking to Mark Hall about Tullochmann, which is a Pictish carved stone, and he mentioned the fact that somebody had found one of these objects in a field on Sheriff Muir. I met up with Mark, a fellow called Dr. Hugo Anderson Weimark of the National Museum, and Joseph Shepherd, who actually discovered this item.
Every winter I come and do a bit of tree planting. And I was out here, it was a very frosty, cold morning. Half the job was frozen. So I ended up down in this little hollow. And I was about a few hours into my day planting trees. And I looked down on the ground. I saw a very round object looking up at me. And I've worked before with pebbles, making pebble mosaics. And I know that the perfect circle doesn't appear very often in nature.
If at all.
If at all, yes, that's right. So I knew this was something special and dug it up, and instantly I realised what it was, as I'd been reading a book about Neolithic man and have an interest in the subject, you know? So, yeah, I picked it up out of the ground and I was just delighted, leaping around and jumping up in the air. Yeah, I was ecstatic. I've been looking for things like this my whole life. I always scour the ground looking for... treasures and beachcombing.
You hit the jackpot.
Jackpot, exactly, yes, aye. But I was the only one on the job, so there was no one else to show. So I had to wait till they turned up a bit later to show it to all my pals.
Mark Hall from the Perth Museum has actually got the object with him. And you got it in a wee Perspex box.
wrapped up in bubble wrap. Wow. That's glorious. Right, you describe it.
Well, actually, I might defer to my colleague here, Hugo, to describe it, because he's done the closest analysis of it to date. So, Hugo.
Well, it's a lovely piece of green igneous rock, and it's been shaped, so it's got six bosses all over it. So it fits nicely in your hand.
Uh-huh.
It's got six sort of round knobs, equally spaced across the surface. And the whole surface has sort of been pecked and then ground smooth. And then on two of those knobs, one of them's been decorated with a sort of lattice work of very fine incisions. The sort of thing you'd make with a flint blade, just cutting across it very carefully. And then on the other decorated boss, there's just five lines, more crudely done. So it looks slightly like a different hand has perhaps decorated that boss. But it's very finely worked. It's a beautiful thing.
It is a truly beautiful thing. And I know that over 500 of these things have been found throughout Scotland. I'm not lying here. It's just as well Joseph found it, because if I'd found it, you'd have heard nothing about it at all. It's gorgeous.
Well, we always rely on people reporting their finds through Treasure Trove. Yeah. I mean, found objects, you know, they belong to the state. Yeah. And they can be reported through the Treasure Trove system. And ultimately, they end up in museums where we can all appreciate them, and that's, you know, really valuable.
Yeah, yeah. When we decided to try and fund our acquisition of this through a public campaign, it went so much easier than we thought. And through the good offices of the Purchaser Society for Natural Sciences, which meant we could match that with another grant and pay the reward allocation that the Crown Office has set against it.
Take it back a stage for me. So, Joseph finds it.
Yep.
He reports it, hands it in. It's declared treasure trove by whom?
Colleagues of Hugo's at the National Museum, known as the Treasure Trove Unit, who are part of the Crown Office's responsibility with respect to treasure trove. So material is turned into those two people, and they kind of decide, is this significant archaeology or not? And if it's significant archaeology, it then gets declared treasure trove. And then museums in the relevant area where things are found are notified so that they can decide as to whether they want to make a bid for those interesting pieces. And then those bids are decided upon by a committee who report to the Crown Office, and that's the Scottish Archaeological Finds Allocation Panel.
So they decide, yes, officially it's treasure trove, and there is going to be a reward paid for this. And if a museum wants it, they have to effectively pay the reward. Who gets paid the reward? Is it the landowner or the finder?
In the Scottish system, landowners have no rights in respect to,
really?
To objects that are found on the land. Well, because it's deemed to be Crown-owned. So, in effect, the Crown is the landowner. And then a reward is paid to the finder. So in this case, Joseph will be the recipient if he hasn't been already.
Yes, I have, yeah. Very grateful for it too. If it had been a lump of gold, I would have handed it in immediately, but with this, it was a very personal find that with personal significance to me because of my interest in stone and that period of history. But I'm very happy that it's going to Perth Museum, and I think it should be enjoyed by the general public.
Coming back to the object itself, Hugo, what was the purpose of them? Has anybody ever decided?
Well, there's plenty of theories out there. Basically, because it doesn't have a sort of obvious function to it, people have thought long and hard and debated over the last 150 years, really, as to what they could have been used for. People have looked at weights and measures, because they're all about the same size, that size that fits in your hand. But they all weigh totally different weights, because it depends on the rock they used. Some are sandstone, some are quite heavy igneous rocks. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those ideas, you know, that have some practical function like that, don't necessarily fit. People have considered whether they could be used as weapons.
It's almost like a mace head or something.
Yeah, like a mace head. And actually, mace heads, this is 5,000 years old, and that's exactly the same time we see mace heads in the archaeological records. These are the two sort of contemporary, very prestigious objects.
My favourite, though, for the 19th century was the idea that it was a bolas, you know, that people would have these on the end of a leather, like the gauchos in Argentina, and swing it round the legs of an animal, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, you would use the grooves to tie
it's fun.
Bits of rope
yeah. There's never been any damage on them either, you know. This one's intact. If it had been used for a weapon, it would have been chipped and damaged.
Yeah, so for every suggestion of how they might have been used, there's a counter-suggestion of why that doesn't work.
Yeah.
But I think the key thing here is when we look at these objects, they are clearly important. They're very tactile objects. You know, it's all about handling them. They roll in your hand. They seem to be objects that have potentially often had very long biographies. So they're not perhaps just made in one go, like we would just manufacture something today. They've gone through a long process of being manufactured. So someone might have turned it into a sphere of stone. It might at a later date decided setting out the knobs on the surface, then cutting those grooves deeper, someone grinding the surface, someone else sort of decorating it. It could have been something that occurred over generations.
Given the fact where we are, we're about 800 feet above sea level, we're up in Sheriff Muir, we're in the middle of a ploughed park, essentially, being planted with trees. Why? Why on earth would it be here?
It wasn't in an archaeological feature. So all we know is it's in the soil. And, you know, it's not a bad spot up here. The view is wonderful. You know, we have water nearby. It's a nice perspective over the local landscape. And in this area, we've also found flints and bits of pitchstone, some of which come all the way from Arran. The only places these have actually ever been found in context is up in Orkney, where they've been found on the floors of the buildings at Scarabray, and one was found at the Ness of Brodgar in 2013. So it could well be that this was just a good spot to live.
There are clues to it. Just a few hundred metres that way to the north, there was a stone circle, and a couple of stone circles to the south of us, as well as a stone alignment.
Be honest with me, Joseph. Mm-hmm. Having hit the motherlode here, how much time have you spent here since wondering about?
The next day I came back and had a good wander around, yeah, and for the rest of that day I had my eyes pinned to the ground. And then we had a little site visit here with Mark and Hugo and myself, and that's when we turned up these extra flint finds. My theory of these bulls is that they were made by the same people that built the stone circles, because that's an example of sacred geometry, and that same geometry was used to build the stone circles and to work out the planetary alignments.
It's interesting, you know, Mark's standing directly in front of me holding this thing, and you are playing with it. You can't help but play with it.
As Hugo said earlier, they are incredibly tactile objects, and it's an irresistible thing to do, and it's a privileged thing.
Mark Holder, Dr. Hugo Anderson, why Mark, and Joseph Shepherd, who actually found the Sheriff Muir ball. If you want to see what it looks like, go to our Facebook page, Out of Doors Facebook, and have a shifty at it.
I would be tempted to keep it if I found it.
Well, that's what we discussed. And what was interesting, you know, Mark picked up on it immediately and said, yeah, we quite understand that. But by handing it in, by going through the official process, lots of people get to enjoy it.
Yeah,
you're still struggling with that concept, I can tell.
Quite as generous of spirit as that. Now, this week saw the launch of the RSPB's Let Nature Sing campaign, and it's basically about highlighting the number of species that have become extinct, and I was staggered by the numbers involved here. What they've taken is a collection of some of the bird song of these endangered species and put them together, and they're hoping it's going to top the charts. Kirsty Nutt is the communications manager for the RSPB in Aberdeen.
We released a pure birdsong track, which features...
How good is that?
It's amazing, and it features lots of birds that are sort of threatened, so curlew, cuckoo, nightingale, turtle dove, those sorts of noises. And the purpose of it is to really raise awareness that a lot of those iconic sounds are at risk of being lost from the countryside.
The call of a curlew on a Scottish night, or the sound of an oyster catcher, it just puts the hairs up the back of your neck.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've lost 40 million birds in the UK in the last 50 years. And people are just not aware of it. And I guess the point of this is to raise awareness of that. It's been made by sort of professional musicians. So it's been made by Sam Lee and Bill Barkley, who's the musical director at the Globe Theatre, using recordings that a guy called Adrian Thomas has made. And they're all brand new recordings that have been made on our nature reserves across the UK. And I guess edited or arranged, I guess is the musical term, into this single. It's nice. It's unusual for us to spend, you know, a couple of minutes listening to nothing but birdsong, but it's, you know, it's great. It makes everyone feel positive and relaxed, and it's a great thing.
So is this a download?
Yep, you can buy it on CD or available for digital download. Yeah, basically get out there and have a listen.
Now, you're saying this is a happy thing, a celebration, but it's slightly tragic as well. I mean, is it numbers of birds or is it species?
So it's 40 million individual birds is what the calculation is. It's in a DEFRA report, State of UK Birds. But something like 50%, more than 50% of the wildlife in the UK is in decline, 165 species classed as critically endangered. And I think, as well as being a wonderful, joyous thing to listen to, it's also a bit of a wake-up call to, you know, raise awareness of this, because I think people really care about wildlife and a lot of people are not aware of the challenges it faces.
Apart from those that put nets on trees and fence off bits, and don't get me started on that. You know, we are supposedly a nation of bird lovers, but some people seem to go out of their way not to like them.
I think it's just sometimes a lack of awareness of the impact of your actions and things like that. And I think the purpose of this is, you know, really celebrating what we love about UK wildlife, but also trying to raise awareness of the trouble it's in and try and actually, you know, in this busy world of lots going on in our lives, get it a sort of seat at the table of conversation and realise that, you know, if we do care about nature and, you know, and the importance for our enjoyment of life and our health and our well-being, you know, as well as for the sake of nature itself, then actually we do need to talk about it and we do need to raise awareness of it and we do need to make political decisions that helps it.
So is that, this is one of these questions that has no easy answer, is it habitat loss? Is it just the way we're polluting our planet? Is it cats? A combination of all of them?
It's a mixture of things. So a lot of it is, you know, competition for, you know, habitats, so our choices and our land use and what we do and our developments where we're, you know, sort of squeezing out wildlife, sort of lack of food, lack of homes, things like that. You know, some stuff is bigger. So, you know, seabird declines are due to climate change, for example. So, you know, it's a whole heap of things, but it doesn't mean that there's not stuff we can do about it. And but in order to do stuff about it, we have to be talking about it. So Let Nature Sing, which is the name of the single and of the campaign that we're doing, is all about that. It's about, you know, raising awareness of the plight that wildlife faces so that we can all come together and say, actually, we do want something done and we're going to take action to do something.
How do you download it? Where do you get it?
So any of your usual places where you download your music from will have it available.
Get your grandchildren to do it for you.
Yeah, that's not even your grandchildren.
Kirsty Nutt of the RSPB, and I think that's a bit booming in the background.
So there's somebody blowing across an open bottle.
Possibly.
It's a great noise.
It's a cracking noise.
All too rarely heard. I've only heard it a couple of times on a still night. Certainly down in Suffolk, in that part of the world, you hear them booming away, and it's great.
That churring noise, was it a nightjar?
It could be. I've never seen. What? In fact, it's not true. I was down doing a programme, and we're walking along a boardwalk. Mm-hmm. In a kind of boggy land, and the guy said, oh, there's a nightjar. I wouldn't. Yeah. And, you know, when you've, that's the joy of doing this job. You've got somebody who can say, look in there, and I'm looking at it for 5 minutes. Oh, there.
Yeah.
Oh, saying that, I spotted the lizard up in the north coast of Scotland, which was quite impressive.
I saw a lizard just this last week.
It's the first I've seen for years.
Now, I mean, this is going to sound utterly ridiculous, but I stopped to take a close-up photograph of a fence post. Because it was covered in lichen and it was gnarled and it just had so much character and the colours were fantastic on it. And as I put my foot forward, this lizard went, you know, and it, 800 feet up in Sheriff Muir, it wasn't where I expected it to be. Wasn't that a great idea either? Anyway, that is it for this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Join us next week if you can. Until such time, from all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.